The following is part of WFMP's Public Affairs Educational Programming. The views expressed are those of the speakers and not the station. If you would like to share your views, you may email us at wfmp.louisville@gmail.com. Welcome, everybody. I am Ruth Newman, your host, and this is Election Connection.
What's the word?
Democracy.
Now what's the word?
Democracy.
What's the word?
Democracy.
Yeah, what's the word?
Democracy.
You need to know.
Democracy.
Make it grow.
Democracy.
The seeds you sow will spread democracy. You need to know.
Democracy.
Make it grow.
Democracy.
Don't let it go. Democracy. Don't let it go.
Democracy.
Now what's the word?
Democracy.
Yeah, what's the word?
Democracy.
Now what's the word?
Democracy.
Hey, what's the word?
Democracy.
You need to know.
Democracy.
Make it grow.
Democracy.
The seeds you sow will spread democracy. You need to know.
Democracy.
Make it grow.
Democracy.
Don't let it go. Democracy. Don't let it go. Democracy. We are your
election connection.
We are your
election connection.
We are your
election connection.
That was Carolyn Dowd, who composed and sings, along with a few friends, our new theme song for the show, Election Connection. And today I am here with Angeline Rudd, Victoria Strange, and Melissa Morganson. And these are all people very passionate about democracy and voting and elections, and especially now in this era that we're living in.
Hard to describe, isn't it?
Yes. Alternate truth. I, first of all, want to explain what the three goals of the program are, which is to give you, the listeners, timely and up-to-the-minute information on what you need to do and how and when you need to do it in order to cast your vote in upcoming elections. That's the first goal. The second goal is to provide you with some background and context with regard to our current election process. And the third goal is to shine some light on some of the major threats to our election system, especially the more recent ones. And so today we're going to have like a freewheeling discussion. But first, I want to give everyone, my buddies here and you out in the listening audience, a pop quiz. So does anyone know when the next Kentucky general election is? Anybody?
November 5th.
Very good.
Question mark, question mark.
November 5th. And does anyone know who's running for office?
Andy Beshear.
Yes.
Matt
Bevin.
Bevin, our illustrious current governor.
For attorney general.
I believe there's a Republican by the last name of Cameron.
Exactly.
Who is African American.
Daniel Cameron.
And I believe he is a Bevin protege, but I could be wrong about that.
Probably.
And he's running against the Democrat, Greg Stumbo.
Oh, yes.
And then Secretary of State.
Okay.
Is that Heather French?
Yes.
Heather French.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That's
very
right.
Good. And Michael Adams.
Okay, I didn't know
Michael Adams. And when is the deadline to be able to register to vote in this election?
It's a month before the election or something like that?
Yes, it's a month. October the 7th is the last day that you can register. And there's plenty of different ways to register. You can register online. You can go to the Jefferson County Clerk's office. I've got listed the downtown branch, the Westport branch, Middletown East branch, Jeffersontown, Dixie, Fairdale, and Highview. But it's easier to just go online. You can go to elections.jeffersoncountyclerk.org. There's a bunch of places you can go to. You can just go to jeffersoncountyclerk.org. And on your cell phone, you can go to govote.org. Kentucky spelled KY.com, govoteky.com. And you can get all kinds of voting information, including registering to vote. So when is the absentee ballot deadline for voting absentee?
I know you have to apply for a ballot at least 7 days prior to the election,
exactly,
so that you have time to receive it by mail. And I believe your completed ballot has to be received in the county clerk's office, I assume, by 6 p.m. on election day, because that's when the polls close, conveniently.
Yes, yes.
At 6 p.m.
And
so
we are one of the few states that close so early.
Yes. Yes. Well, we can't let too many people vote,
no,
right?
Oh, and another announcement I want to make is National Voter Registration Day, which is September the 24th, and there's going to be lots of activities going on that day, especially if you'd like to get in touch with the Louisville League of Women Voters, and their website is www.lwvlouisville.org. And LWV I've got in all caps, then Louisville.org. And their phone number is 502-895-5218. So get involved. All right, so today we're going to talk a little bit about election equipment. And we're also going to talk about other aspects. But first, let's talk about election equipment. Because, as a lot of you know, and maybe one of us here can explain what happened in the 2000 election with the Florida ballot counting. What exactly happened in that incident? Was it Gore versus Bush?
Bush v. Gore.
Well, they were using in, I guess it was Miami-Dade County, and possibly other counties as well, somewhat antiquated punch card voting machines that actually, I guess, you line up mechanically on a voting machine your votes, and you put your card in. I'm not sure exactly how they work, but they, however you've aligned the pegs or whatever it is, levers that you're voting with, it punches a card. And of course, sometimes the punches didn't go all the way through, and
we
but you could
hanging chads
because the vote was so close. A recount was conducted, and that's where you got all the pictures of election supervisors peering up at the light through these ballot cards punched to determine the intent of the voter, to determine if they had intended to vote for Bush or Gore and whoever else was on the ballot.
So that turned into a fiasco, and Congress provided $3.6 billion to states and territories to upgrade their election system. And that was in order to establish minimum standards for voting systems. And for that purpose, they created the Elections Assistance Commission, the EAC, in 2002. And that turned out to be the first time that the feds provided funding for state election systems. And the mandate of the Elections Assistance Commission, or the EAC, is to promote the effective administration of federal elections. So that hasn't turned out too well in the intervening years for a number of reasons, one of which is that it's overseen by a guy named Brian Newby, who was appointed by our friend Chris Kobach, yes, who we talked about last week, and he is the head of the EAC. He's the executive director. It's supposed to have four commissioners, but the latest information that I got from ProPublica is that there are only two commissioners, one of whom is Christy McCormick, who has derided the notion of Russian meddling in the 2016 election. In 2016, she wrote, "It is my opinion that the entire thing is complete BS." And ProPublica has asked repeatedly if Ms. McCormick's views have changed, and she has repeatedly refused to answer.
Stonewalling, very characteristic of
yes,
the way things operate now.
That's
in
right,
government. No transparency.
No.
And on top of that, the executive director, Brian Newby, has blocked travel of key staffers at the EAC who specialize in cybersecurity, preventing them from attending what training sessions have taken place, according to ProPublica.
They prevented them from...
from attending sessions, yeah.
For education on...
training sessions for the various, for all of our states. Yeah.
What is ProPublica again?
Yes, it's a nonprofit organization that aims to produce investigative journalism, and in 2010, it became the first online news source to win a Pulitzer Prize. And since then, it has partnered with over 90 different news organizations and has won 5 Pulitzer Prizes.
Including the Courier Journal, recently.
Very good. Oh.
And I think it's mostly formed of journalists who got laid off in the great continuing mass layoffs in journalism all over the country. So these are professionals. It's not a bunch of hacks. It's real professional journalists.
But they seem like they're pretty legit.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's so odd that this is what seems to me is happening on the Republican side. They seem to be assuming that any meddling in an election, in an American election, will be to assist them. Mm-hmm. And so they're taking no action. I mean, maybe I should say the Trump administration in particular. I mean, to me that is so strange. Because if there's meddling in an election, why couldn't it...
go the other direction?
Yeah, why couldn't it go the other way just as easily? And Trump has basically openly on national television invited foreign governments to interfere. Yes. When he was being interviewed, I think it was by George Stephanopoulos in the Oval Office, and George asked him if he would still take a meeting with the Russians who were offering dirt, or any foreign government who was offering dirt on his opponent. And he said, I think you'd take that call. I mean, that was just, well, there are so many daily scandals that you forget it, but that was just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So basically, there's an open invitation. The welcome mat is out. And you just wonder, why does one side seem to believe that any meddling will be in their favor? And why wouldn't you want to protect America's election system? It should not be a partisan issue.
Yeah, according to McConnell and other Republicans, they oppose it because it imposes federal standards on an issue that is traditionally handled by states.
That's, even though that's a federal election is federal.
Yes, yes.
Not state.
And we're now dealing with nations and mercenaries of nations. Larry Nordum of the Brennan Center for Justice says it is unrealistic to expect all of this investment in election infrastructure to fall to the local level. The Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law is a nonpartisan law and policy institute that works to reform, revitalize, and when necessary, defend our country's systems of democracy and justice. This is what they have as their mission on their website. Grover Norquist, who's president of the Americans for Tax Reform,
yes,
a Republican,
we remember him.
The best estimates show that we can replace all paperless voting machines in the U.S. for about the cost of a single F-22 fighter jet. It's not practical to expect local election administrators in rural areas to go toe-to-toe with the premier government-backed cyber mercenaries of China, Russia, and North Korea.
Yeah. So, good point.
Very
Grover.
Good point, Grover. Probably one of the few things I've...
And here's what Oregon Senator Ron Wyden said at this year's DEF CON conference. He said, quote, I'll be damned that when we are up against the Russians and all their military and all their cybersecurity might, we're going to send out the county IT guy.
So what does he suggest the solution is?
Actually, what I've been finding in my research is the most immune system to any kind of hacking is paper voting. And that can be optically scanned. And actually, Jefferson County does use that. We have an optical scanner, and we also have paper voting. But 91 of Kentucky's 120 counties use machines that do not provide paper records. So, yeah.
So unless there's a recount, because you do have the paper ballots that you vote on as a backup, but
sometimes,
unless there's some reason for a recount, you're never going to know if that tallies with what the machine totaled.
But and remember all those little places that had mysteriously lost their paper yes. ballots or misfiled them or, oh, we've shredded them or, you know.
Right, like a week after the election.
That's right. Right. So I don't know if paper is the answer either.
Well, in my reading of research for this, I have discovered that there have been problems with those optical scan machines well.
Oh, yeah.
So they're not immune, but at least they have a paper backup. And remember, in the old days, my sister lives in France. I'm not sure that this is still the case, but I can remember talking with her about this after the 2000 election because I was so distraught. And she mentioned that in the little precincts, I'm not sure what the French equivalent of precinct is, but they vote on paper. I don't think they use a machine. They vote on paper, and the votes are counted the evening after the election, you know, the same day, but that night, whenever the polls close, in each little precinct, and there are members of each political party that was on the ballot.
So are they hand counted?
They're hand counted in front of the entire village. If you want to come and watch them count the votes, you come and watch them count the votes. Now, that would seem to me to be a tougher system to crack. There are probably still ways to do it, you know, good old-fashioned bribery.
Yes, right.
Like in this country, you know, the old phrase, stuffing the ballot box. That was when we voted on paper. But it's at least it's in front of the public, and pretty much in that little préfecture or whatever they might call it, people know how they voted. They probably have a decent idea how their neighbors voted, and if the votes were really, really oddly different from what was anticipated, because they also do exit polling, and it's very, very difficult to explain. This is one of the anomalies in the 2000 election, Bush v. Gore. The exit polling all pointed to Gore winning, and then suddenly he wasn't winning. So, and the same with Bush Kerry. So that was an anomaly that still hasn't been explained to this day.
Well, you know, have you heard of something called flipped voting?
No.
I found this in ProPublica's, one of their publications. During the voting for the 2018 Texas general election, an election advisory was issued by the director of elections, Keith Ingram. Voters using the InterCivic eSlate voting machine, which in fact is what Louisville uses, could have their votes adjusted or flipped while on the summary page. And a flipped vote occurs when a voter selects a candidate, but the voting machine shows a different selection.
Can they program it to do that? Or is it just a glitch? How does that...
I don't know, but they have problems. They all have problems. And what was it that we used to use before all of this?
Well, I remember voting on those old machines with the little curtain that you pulled behind you when you stepped in, and then you pushed down. It was a metal sort of box that sat in front of you with levers that you pulled down.
And I like what France is doing, I think, with the, you know, and then have a Democrat and Republican.
Yes.
In that precinct, sitting with them, so you pass it down a line, and people can watch if you want to watch. But like
the public is invited; it's not just the party people.
And you have the nonpartisan, and then you pass it to each partisan, so they can verify it, and there's no questions asked in each precinct. There's
and
no
it's
way to
the
mess
same.
That up.
They get their results. There's there's no endless recounting. There's no court battles. I mean, I'm speaking secondhand. There could very well things might have changed. This was, almost 20 years ago.
I mean, it does seem primitive, but if it's hack-proof.
And if you're voting in smaller, of course, she lives in a fairly rural part of
France. Yeah, I don't know how you do it in
part of
like
France.
Yeah.
You'd have to just have smaller,
small
precincts. Small. You'd have to shrink them, and that would mean a lot more man
and
woman power.
It's really not that
much,
though. If you think of each precinct, and only, 12% really show up, maybe 20% like in a presidential, that's not that many votes for each precinct. I mean, maybe a couple thousand?
Yeah.
That's not a big deal.
Yeah, I don't know.
Kentucky has 3,700 precincts.
Okay, interesting. I did not know that.
I do know it takes 1 million votes to beat Mitch McConnell and $100 million.
Wow.
Well, that's
I'll write a check.
it might bounce.
It's $1,000 per vote that you spend right now.
Wow.
Well, money in politics, I believe, is another saboteur of the democratic process. Yeah, one other thing about lever machines and punch card machines, they last longer. They last decades, whereas the voting machines we have now do not last a decade.
It's like a computer.
Yeah,
so,
right.
And you know, we all know how that goes.
Yes.
it's planned obsolescence, you know.
Right.
According to ProPublica, over two-thirds of counties in America use machines for the 2016 election that are over a decade old. And at the same time, the states have been dragging their heels on providing any money because states and localities just don't have the money. It's a very low priority. And we can be sure it's a low priority here in Kentucky. And on top of that, Kentucky no longer gets any money from HAVA, Help America Vote.
But we don't all vote in Kentucky on the optical scan machines.
No.
And do we have any of those touchscreen machines that have no paper trail? I wonder if we have those.
Most of Kentucky's voting machines have no paper trail.
Unbelievable.
Most of them.
Because I know that was a huge problem in Georgia.
91 of Kentucky's 120 counties use machines that do not provide paper records.
Unbelievable.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Jefferson County is among only 6 counties that exclusively use paperback systems that provide a paper record. So 6 out of 190.
Wow.
Yep.
That is quite staggering. I did not know that. I thought most of the counties voted on the same type of machines that we have, but that was just an assumption on my part.
As a matter of fact, I found out what machines most of the Kentucky counties vote on. It's called the Hart InterCivic eSlate, and that's the voting machine company that is heavily invested in by the Romneys. The Romneys pretty much own that company.
And I wonder if that's the machine where I was reading in this wonderful book that's available online, free of charge, written by Bev Harris, who was just a normal everyday grandma like you and me, who got very alarmed after the 2000 election and started digging into some of these questions, the voting machine anomalies, the lack of paper, the problems in past elections leading up to 2000. And one of the things she mentions is that on, and it may be this type of machine, the backup is about the size of a credit card. You put it into the machine at the end of the day, download the data, and then those are all tabulated on a central computer somewhere, right. And then the cards and the tabulation is placed in a sealed envelope and delivered to the appropriate county election supervisor. You know, for each county, the various precincts are done that way. Well, there was an incident in November 2002, so that would have been a midterm election when Bush was the president, the very first midterm after his election. In Fulton County, Georgia, election officials stated that memory cards from 67 electronic voting machines had been misplaced. So the ballots cast on those machines were left out of the totals. They located 56 of the cards later. Those contained 2,180 ballots, but 11 cards were still missing 2 days after the election.
Oh my God.
And this is when she mentions that a memory card is just like a ballot box, and that these cards are about the size of a credit card. She interviewed a Georgia computer programmer, and when this computer programmer quizzed Dr. Britt Williams, who is the official voting machine certifier for the state of Georgia, in a public meeting, Mr. Williams explained that the memory cards had not been lost after all, but they had been inadvertently left in the machines.
Oh my goodness.
And then she goes on to say that if you have 7 voting machines, for instance, at a polling place, each one has a memory card that stores its votes, so you have 7 separate cards. You take all those cards, you put them into a single machine, which accumulates them and runs a report. You know, the cards are put in an envelope with that tabulation and given to the county tabulator with a printout of the accumulated results. So if the votes are accumulated from all the cards before they're being transmitted to the county, this means all the votes would be transmitted as one batch. So why did 2,180 more votes show up when the individual cards were found to be still inside the machines instead of left out? Because if they were inadvertently put back in the machines instead of being sent to the tabulator, you would have still had the votes counted. You know, you ran the votes and then you put them back in the machine, which was apparently their explanation. So it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Probably never know the exact vote total for that election in that county. And think how easy it would be. And what she did was she compared each of those credit card-like things. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like a, you know, what we used to call in the old days a floppy disk, and now we call a hard drive or a flash drive or whatever. You could stuff those in your sleeve, put them in your pocket, in your purse, and each one of those is like a ballot box. In the old days, which was a big, you know, a big box full of paper ballots, but now your ballot box is the size of a credit card. And how easy is it to get rid of a ballot box now? It's a heck of a lot easier.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Did we talk about the DEF CON Las Vegas conference yet? And what they were able to do with five different style voting machines? They were able to hack, what was it, in less than a day? Or was it less than an hour?
I think it's even less. This year was really phenomenal.
Less than two minutes?
They had kids come in.
I've read less than 2 minutes to hack into a voting machine.
But this year, DEF CON, the Defense Department, brought in their machine and said it's unhackable, and they offered a $10 million reward for anyone who could hack it. And then it malfunctioned. So that was really nice.
So they didn't get to test it?
No.
Somebody explain what DEF CON is, because I'm not sure I know exactly.
It's the hackers conference.
So you're a loud and proud hacker?
Yes. Okay. And companies actually bring things to it to test.
Yeah.
Because the hackers will tell you what you've done wrong.
The term DEF CON comes from the movie War Games, referencing the U.S. Armed Forces Defense Readiness Condition, or DEF CON. Okay, here's what Wikipedia has to say about DEF CON. DEF CON is one of the world's largest and most notable hacker conventions held annually in Las Vegas, Nevada. The first DEF CON took place in June of 1993, and today many attendees at DEF CON include computer security professionals, journalists, lawyers, federal government employees, security researchers, students, and hackers with a general interest in software, computer architecture, hardware modification, and anything else that can be, quote, hacked, unquote.
Yeah, Elon Musk, he commissions China to try to hack into the Teslas. So he dares them all to try to bust in, and then whenever they get a breakthrough, then he fixes the car so it doesn't. So he pays them to try to hack in.
Well, it's very smart.
Very smart.
And
I'm glad to hear that our Department of Defense actually is trying to
work.
But this wasn't a voting machine. It was some...
No, it was.
It was.
It was a voting machine that they're designing, that they're trying to make unhackable, but I don't know how you could ever make it.
Look, there are things like Bitcoin, and there's a lot of things. Most things can be hackable, but there are a lot of things that have
blockchain.
A hard time getting... Yeah.
Blockchain makes it difficult.
Exactly. So
but
we could do that, but I do like the paper idea.
Yeah, I do.
I know.
And what is the charge for someone stealing one of those credit cards up their sleeve? Like, is it a felony? Is it life imprisonment? Like, can we, so that somebody tries to
You could always just
bribe.
Say you forgot. I was taking these to the office and I had an emergency
but
call.
But if we say there's severe punishment that goes along with it, it'll be harder to bribe some poor little precinct captain to do it.
Yes.
If we have really strict guidelines and we say this has to be the protocol, these are people's, this is our country.
Yeah,
we're putting
democracy.
On the line. And that is our democracy. And if you say this is a first degree felony, minimum 20-year sentence if this card is missing, that card probably won't end up missing.
It's just fascinating to me. I mean, I need to look back in this and get all the details, but it's just unbelievably crazy that we've gotten to this point where it's so easy A, to hack into a machine, because I've read reports from others' conventions. I didn't realize they were called DEF CON, but it was minutes. Yeah, minutes right. when presented with a voting machine that they haven't seen before.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Within minutes, they're inside. And I keep thinking, okay, if it's that easy for our folks here in the States to hack into these machines, is there something they have that foreign governments wouldn't have? That mm-hmm. I mean, why would it be just as simple for someone on the other side of the planet to hack into mm-hmm. a Jefferson County voting machine?
Just as
or is it just as easy?
Just as easy. Yeah. With the internet, everything makes it easy.
And that's another thing, is that the one thing I read about Kentucky voting machines is that they are not connected to the internet, thank God. But a lot of voting machines are.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder what happens when you go to tabulate the results. Is that a computer that's tied to the internet? I mean, that would be interesting to know, because a lot of times, like in the 2000 election, I think the results were, and the 2004, the results were being tabulated in a small number of central, like, servers.
Mm-hmm. Just to remind you, you've been listening to Election Connection on Forward Radio, WFMP 106.5 FM, and I'm your host, Ruth Newman, here with Angeline Rudd, Melissa Morganson, and Victoria Strange, and we have been talking about things to do with elections, in particular with voting machines. So let's join in on the conversation as we continue to talk about voting machines.
Well, you look at when we were in school and you had to fill in the number 2 pencil and the little dot. When those were running the machine, those weren't online, I don't believe.
No.
Those were just, and maybe that, because it's the same kind of fill in the number 2 pencil on the circle, so it's probably similar.
Yeah.
Too bad that only 6 counties in Kentucky use those machines, because it does seem like they would be a bit more secure.
Yeah, they are. They're considered to be the most hacking immune method is paper ballots with the pencils.
And probably the most hacking immune would be no machines, paper ballots, and people counting them in front of other people. You know, with a check.
Which would take a long time, longer time.
We have a much bigger country and a lot more votes to count than France, but they don't have a tiny number of votes. I mean,
yeah, I never really buy into that. You know, like in Scandinavia, they're like, well, that's smaller countries. They can do their political system. I'm like, it doesn't, you know, it's just a number. We've got just as many people. We can do it on a grander scale.
Yes. Just scale it accordingly.
I mean, we're supposed to have all of these interconnected organizations that can do all of this in our country. Mm-hmm. So just say that we have 100 Scandinavias or
exactly.
And I also read that Maryland's election website uses software called ByteGrid, which is owned by a Putin associate.
Oh my gosh. Yes. What do they mean by associate? Like, they're peeps?
Yeah,
they didn't work together.
Elaborate, so I don't know what the connection is with Putin, just said a Putin associate. So that leaves a little bit to be desired in information.
Gosh.
It's too bad, because there is a House passed bill, the election security bill this year, that would authorize over $600 million for updating voting equipment, including requirements that voting machines produce a paper record and stay disconnected from the internet and be produced in the United States. We don't even have that rule, but they have to be produced in the United States. So that is what has been blocked by McConnell.
Yes.
That.
And what was his reasoning?
And his reason was that it imposes federal standards on an issue traditionally handled by states.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to have too much trouble imposing his standards on the rest of the country. Okay, was that too politically incorrect? Seems an odd thing for him to be concerned about.
Well, now we're going to get into why people are so ill-informed. Because in my opinion, the whole reason that we have a free and independent, or we used to have a free and independent media, is so that we can inform the public. So the public can make the right decisions for, you know, advancing our democracy. But that doesn't appear to be what we have in the media today for various and sundry reasons. And what's been appearing over the years has been more of a horse race approach to coverage of elections by the media. I mean, I've got all kinds of data on like 9 out of 10 news reports are the horse race.
What do you mean by horse race?
It's who's ahead in the polls, who's behind in the polls.
How can this person catch up in the polls?
Yes.
What message should they?
Who's losing?
What message should
they be? It's all popularity contests, and it's constant, you know, cluing in on polling data.
Yeah. I think
rather than platform and issues.
Right.
I will issue a note of optimism here. I think that might be beginning to change. I mean, well, there was just a town hall for the Democratic candidates that lasted for 7 hours.
Oh.
And in fact, the coverage I heard on the radio was that it was great, but people just didn't have time to listen for seven hours. So they went to the extent of allowing the candidates to really talk about the issues, and it was all on the climate crisis, you know, the whole, that was the sole topic.
Wouldn't it be amazing to have a paper one and do with like start small and work our way, and then at the end, like on the news or whatever, we bring all those paper ballots together. Like, this is our country. This is democracy. Like, do we actually have a visual impact of this?
This is how we all work together.
Right.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Inspiring. I think the results would be somewhat different.
I think so.
Sure.
I mean,
it would be so interesting just to have real democracy.
Mm-hmm. But also, we'd have faith, because even if the results aren't different, which I agree, I think they will be, but even if they aren't those of us on the left would be like, okay, well, we have work to do.
Yes.
You know?
Right. Yes.
But like, there are a lot of Trump supporters out there, and it is kind of scary, but I don't know if there are as many as they claim there are, because we don't have faith in the election.
Exactly right.
In the system.
And that should appall people of all political persuasions.
Yeah.
Because once you lose faith in the system, in your government, like, I think that is one of the things that I find so alarming about Donald Trump, is that now it seems as though government agencies are sort of going along. Like, didn't the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration just issue some kind of apologetic remark about, well,
we should never.
Yeah. He was briefed on the early.
The Sharpie over Alabama.
Yes. The early reports might have said there was a possibility Alabama might be grazed or something like that. And so now, instead of defending the scientists, you know, they're
we're babying number 45.
We're babying him, and once the government agencies start going along, then whose information do you trust? Because you know you can't trust anything the president says.
That's true, but I'm also an advocate, especially with a narcissist. Like, once you recognize his psychology, we need to work with that psychology to get through the next 2 years just to not destroy this entire freaking planet. So I do think that sometimes when he does something good, it's good to throw him a bone just so it's not always fake news.
Right.
Because right now, all the right wing has shut us off. They've shut everything off, because no matter what is said, it's fake news. But if we occasionally say, hey, thanks for wanting to put the prices on our medicine on the commercials, that's a good thing. Actually, I'm a little bit supportive of these tariffs in China, because like, I think we are such a disposable country right now. Everything's a dollar, everything's plastic. It's like, that's all China. If we could start creating quality products, you won't have to buy 10 of them. So like, I'm a kind of a fan of producing more in this country. So again, if we can occasionally throw Orange Man a bone when he does something decent.
So I know, and we've been talking about Trump, and that has something to do with the media too, because he was a celebrity before he ran for office, and because of that, the media put a disproportionate amount of attention on him, and his name recognition went way above anyone else, and so he got most of the media coverage, and that was like a positive feedback loop. Then it no longer has anything at all to do with issues or background or credibility or integrity. It all has to do with name recognition. So that, to me, is very undemocratic.
Also, I think maybe part of it is because you, and this is not just specific to Donald Trump, but I don't know why the media doesn't ask the tough questions more mm-hmm. often and not let a politician or pundit get away with just a glib talking point answer.
Right.
Keep pinning them down. I know there are ways to politicians probably learn lots of ways to try to get around that, but it would just be nice to see reporters being a bit more aggressive, you know, just...
I don't know if they can be with the president because they have to handpick who's allowed to interview him, like, in the Oval Office, and they have to, like, agree to only ask specific questions, they have a certain way, and then he can ban them. So it's like their tongues are tied.
Yeah. But other politicians, too, and his cabinet secretaries or his spokespeople or...
And we're going to get into that in another program. Just, the whole election cycle and the debate format and how candidates just get away with 30-second sound bites and there's no follow-up. And then they move on to another subject. And so the voters are left confused. Nobody fact-checks any of these statements, you know? And they should. And that should be part of coverage, the media coverage.
We're getting better about that, though, I feel. As technology advances, I do feel like there was the one news channel on the last, I guess, election, or it was a speech, and it was like a fact check on the side of it, and it said, this is true, this is 97% true. Like, it actually did the fact checking while he was speaking. I'm like, this is incredible. I feel like we have improved, you know, from the past couple decades.
And there are fact checking, you know, well-established and reliable fact-checking sites on the internet, which we will, at some future point, give you those addresses, those internet addresses.
Well, on this topic, before we leave it, I'll just make another point that, yes, Trump handpicks his reporters and does a little interview in the Oval Office, and guess what? Guess what he's effectively eliminated? The presidential press briefing, which used to be a standard.
Yes.
And he does them, you know,
outdoors.
The chopper talk, where he's standing next to the Air Force One chopper and you can barely hear what he's saying because the rotors are whirring. And But, you know, we used to expect our presidents to stand there and answer questions. And he's essentially, he sent out his press secretaries who repeated, you know, false information on more than a few occasions, and then these briefings just slowed to a trickle, and they're basically
gone.
Yeah. Well, we've got Twitter.
True, but then you can't really. And that was where the gaggle could ask questions, and they could. They probably got allowed one follow up, not multiple follow ups. But I still think we've let so many things that were standards and norms, but they weren't. Mm-hmm. Regulations or rules that required, you know, congressional approval, so they're just disappearing because
they're
not convenient for someone who wants to be
how much we're discovering now that we didn't have rules, we just had traditions.
We relied on people to have principles and ethics, and we didn't codify it, however you pronounce that word. It's just a reliance on people to be of good faith, and we have someone who's apparently not.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's not a question of who's winning in the polls and who's losing in the polls.
No.
It's a question of how do we inform people about what they should know in order to make good decisions when voting for candidates. And that's what the news coverage has completely, not completely, but according to one survey, 9 out of 10 stories on coverage of candidates in the news media was about the horse race, who's winning and who's losing. And that was in the 2008 election. So, and it's gotten even worse now. I open the Courier Journal and all I see is polling data, you know, and...
And we're still over a year away from the election.
I know.
I don't know how much longer I can take it.
They should do, like, this week we're going to talk about climate change and who's on board and what's people's ideas. And then, like, even this month. And, you know, next month we're going to talk about campaign finance reform, privatized prisons. Like, Let's, rather than having people having to tune in to each one of the debates for several hours, why doesn't the media like focus on an issue? These 2 weeks, these 2 weeks, or even one week.
Yes,
That's a great idea.
I completely agree.
I know.
Talk about that the platform.
Yeah, maybe we can do some of that.
It'd be good.
On this show. Yes. To our millions of listeners out there. So, but the trouble is that it's like an NBA playoff. And I know it's because they now are a big profit center, the news media, which they didn't used to be, but they are now.
Network, the movie, predicted that.
Yes.
and they're there.
Only interested in the bottom line. As a matter of fact, several years ago, when satellite radio was just coming into being, I went on their website to see about looking for a job. And for their newscasters, they were asking for people. Nobody needed to have any journalism background or political science background. Only marketing and sales. That's what they wanted of their newscasters.
Wow. So, that's, yeah. And they were very upfront about that, right?
Right, I mean, on their website. Yep. That you need not apply if you don't have sales and marketing in your background.
Well,
right.
You probably need not apply if you're an older a woman with, you know, a few wrinkles and gray hair either. I mean, that's one thing I always notice on television news. Obviously, radio is not the same, but the female anchors are always
gorgeous,
young and attractive.
Gorgeous. Yeah, yeah.
The men, not so much, but basically the men, too, kind of fall into
that
the mold.
That is universal in the media. The women have to be
young,
physically beautiful, and the men only have to be obnoxious.
Well, that's in every type of visual.
I know.
Yeah. Visual
I know.
Commercials and
I'm just remembering media. Well, of course, there weren't very many women on the news when I remember listening to the news, but I do remember, as a child, I do remember that the American people trusted those network news programs.
Mm-hmm.
And there were,
all
you know, it was almost, I mean, there were
all
three
white male
all white men, and they were all of three stations.
But look at those people now. Like, look at Dan Rather now. Look at people that have been there for a long time and where they stand politically now. Like, what voice they're using now. And it's really interesting to be like, because sometimes we get accustomed to reality and we're like, okay, this is what we should accept now because this is the world we're living in. But you have people that have been in the roots, like in the trenches for 30 years, and they're like, no! This is not okay. This is not normal. And like, wake up. And it's just, it helps remind us that like, wait a minute, we do need to protest still. This is not okay. We cannot let this get normalized.
Okay.
Right.
And that was one of my biggest fears when Trump was elected, was that these things would become normal. This, because you could see a lot of this coming well before he was elected, just watching his campaign rallies and if you delved into his background and history at all, you could see problems coming. And but I was so afraid that it was just going to become normal. And it's
Hillary outlined them all.
And it's worse than I anticipated.
Yeah.
It really is.
It's
just like the press
storm.
Briefing is gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
With nary a murmur.
Right.
Yeah. 62% of Americans get their news via social media platforms. But what they don't realize is how heavily filtered the social media platforms are.
Skewed to your interests.
They use algorithms, and they are. They're skewed, and it influences our
perceptions. So you don't see the opposing viewpoints?
Right.
Yeah, that's what Russia did, right? They just hacked, they used the algorithms to hack into our social media.
Exactly, yeah.
And persuade people. But I just love the fact that I get on my Facebook and everyone's the same political stance as me. Everyone has the same needs as me. Like, I've done a really good job of just filtering out everything I don't want to see. Like, I love it.
It's like, that's true. There is something good about that, too.
Yeah, right. Like, look, the world is such a happy place. The truth is I just unfollowed.
Yeah, I know. Right. Well, one of these days, reality
is going to come crashing in. And that's the problem with that. You know, it's good to be exposed to opposing viewpoints every now and then. I'm just guilty.
Yes.
I tried Facebook for a while, but I have to admit that I got so mad. Every time I would try to log in, I would get a message that my password wasn't correct.
That's what happened.
I think I probably wound up with 15 different Facebook accounts, and I finally just quit. But I've never, it's still there. I haven't posted in 4 years or something, but I'm not on social media. So I do sometimes look at things on Twitter, but that's because if you want to know what the president's saying, you basically,
yes, right.
You don't have to be on Twitter because we report it. It's reported on the news constantly. Right. But I think it's good to be exposed to
people who disagree. To the ballot thing, wouldn't that be amazing if that was just one thing in our lives that we knew was actually real? Like, the one thing is our vote. It's the one thing that we know is counted. And I think my whole life I've met people that, I don't vote because it's not counted anyway. It's all corrupt. It's like, imagine that one foundation of our democracy where it's like, that is legit. If we can create that, I think that could be a huge shift.
And then we would really and truly have the government we want
we pick
and deserve,
and then we know where the work is. Yeah, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That would be so.
Yes,
it would be crucial to restoring people's faith in the system, quote unquote, their government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think everybody can get on that bandwagon, no matter where you are in your politics.
Yes,
because most everybody in this country believes in democracy.
I also think a bandwagon everyone would get on is your issue, Ruth. The clean elections.
Yes, which is going to be an issue in another program.
I think that's
something
everybody could get behind.
Yeah, everybody except most of our politicians who only win their campaigns because they're funded by special interests. Yeah.
By clean, you mean like not supported by lobbyists or not negative?
Clean elections is a term now. It's an official term that's used by
for the financing of elections.
Yeah, to finance elections.
So no PAC money or no lobbyist money. What do they mean by clean?
What they mean by clean is
public
that
financing.
The candidate can only get money from their constituents, not from any outsider, and they can only in certain states like New Hampshire, Arizona. And in certain cities like Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I believe Portland, Oregon, they can only pay $5. They can only give
$5. That's the limit of campaign donation
is $5 and can only be the constituents in your...
That means only at this point, then only the rich and elite can even run because they have to have their own money. But if we make it the point where you're guaranteed a certain amount of media time for free, but you can't purchase any more than that... Like, that's all you get for media. Like, I feel like it has to be a wide swoop rather than just that, because then you're only going to get the super rich running.
Well, the clean elections works on the basis of public financing. If a candidate gets enough support, you have to have reach a certain critical threshold of support. And that's why they ask for only $5, because they're interested in the numbers of people.
Right, you have to have, like in New York, didn't the AOC have to have like 10,000 signatures to even get on the ballot?
To get on the ballot. And once you get on the ballot and you get that financing from your constituents, then public financing kicks in. And you can compete against people that are being supported by special interests because you're getting public financing. And then you run on the clean elections banner. You can say you're a clean elections candidate. And in the majority, what I read, and this was many years ago, so I don't know if it's changed, but what I read was that in the clean elections states and cities, the majority of winners are clean elections candidates, even though they run against very well financed competitors. Other candidates, they tend to win because people trust that they're not getting special interest money. It's it's a whole trust issue. So I one of these programs is going to be on clean elections.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the media idea too. That's great.
Mm-hmm. I mean, didn't they did that back in the old days, right?
I think
In the 60s and 70s, I think they were allotted specific amount of time on the news.
We should research that.
Yes, and it's going
to
be...
Before news went private. Remember, it used to be public, and there is... I forgot what year, like, they privatized it more. And then it became biased.
And we're going to talk about that. Okay, I'm going to put in some information on the Fairness Doctrine. In 1949, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, introduced the Fairness Doctrine, because the government said it wanted to promote, quote, a basic standard of fairness, unquote, for what was being broadcast. Congress worried that without regulation, the networks could set their own agenda and no other voices would be heard. So stations would keep track of the number of minutes and seconds they dedicated to controversial issues to be sure they could document that they had given equal time to opposing voices. It was ingrained in broadcast journalists' heads to get the other side of the story. And in 1959, a Senate report supporting enforced fairness included this passage. Quote, broadcast frequencies are limited, and therefore they have been necessarily considered a public trust. Every licensee who is fortunate in obtaining a license is mandated to operate in the public interest and has assumed the obligation of presenting important public questions fairly and without bias, unquote. However, in 1987, the FCC repealed most of the fairness doctrine, and in 2011, all of the doctrine's provisions died.
The windfall profits that the media are getting, the broadcasters are getting from these negative
and
campaigns.
And they made so much money off Donald Trump.
Yes, I'm sure.
In the 2016 election. Because he was such a media celebrity already, I guess. But they, it was just like, we can't take our eyes away because the cash is just rolling in. You know? So you got almost saturation coverage of him.
Mm-hmm.
Remember they would cover his rallies start to finish?
They did.
Yeah.
In the beginning, yeah.
In the run-up
to the...
And
then they realized they were all the same, and they kind of said, this is a waste.
Or that they were giving a lot of oxygen to a candidate that was maybe...
Well, they didn't believe he was going to win, come on.
I know. But they sure helped him.
They sure helped him.
They sure did. Well, I guess we're coming to a...
Uh-oh.
Oh, we're coming to a close, so I'm going to say thank you to my guests, Angela and Rudd, Melissa Morganson and Victoria Strange. Thank you guys so much for being on my radio show.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thank you.
One last thing before we leave. We at WFMP 106.5 FM, who believe enough in the power of free and independent local media to volunteer our labor to keep these public airwaves open and accessible, we ask you to show your support during the Give for Good Giant Day of Fundraising, Thursday, September 12th, all day long from midnight to 11:59 p.m. Just go to their website, www.giveforgood, that's all spelled out, giveforgoodlouisville.org, and in the search window, enter Fellowship of Reconciliation, which is our sponsor, and that should take you to our Forward Radio page. The more people we get to donate, the more we become eligible to receive additional funding from the city. So please spread the word. Thank you so much for your support. Thank you for listening to this edition of
Election Connection.